Thank you for downloading this episode of New Books in Sports. I'm your host, Bruce Berglund. For each episode of the podcast, we choose an interesting new book that takes a deeper look at some area of world sport, and we talk with the author. With this episode, I'm pleased to announce a new affiliation between New Books in Sports and the North American Society for Sport History. Over the last four decades, NASH has fostered research and teaching on sports history in the U.S., Canada, and around the world through its annual meetings, book awards, and the Journal of Sport History. We're happy to join with NASH in promoting the academic study of sport. Appropriately, we have a sports historian as a guest for this week's episode. Lindsay Krasnov's day job is with the U.S. Department of State, where she is responsible for briefing diplomats on the history of American relations with the countries where they are posted. As you'd expect of someone in her position, Lindsay's interests and expertise are varied, and one of her areas of research is the history of French sport, especially soccer and basketball. We are discussing today her research on sports policy and youth training programs in post-war France. In our interview, Lindsay discusses how the French government, in the wake of the Second World War and in the midst of Cold War tensions, deliberately sought to train athletes who would better compete on the international stage. In some areas, these efforts were successful. In others, not so much. The title of Lindsay's book is The Making of Les Bleus, Sport in France, from 1958 to 2010. Published in 2012 by Lexington Books. Lindsay spoke to me from the cafe in the State Department headquarters in Washington, D.C. It's an impressive-sounding address, and as you'll hear, it's also a busy one. Still, you'll hear Lindsay without difficulty, and I think you'll enjoy learning about her research, as I did. Here is our interview. Lindsay, welcome to New Books in Sports.
Thank you very much for having me.
So we usually start the interview with a bit of background about our guest, and so I'll ask you to start by explaining what led to your interest in French history and specifically the history of French sport.
Really great questions, and I think it traces back to the fact that once upon a time, I both wanted to be a sports journalist, and I also had a fascination with France that I think goes back to when I was 8 years old and my parents abandoned me to go on vacation in France, and I was deeply hurt and forever marked by it. But that kind of generated my lifelong interest in the country and the culture and the people. I did an MA program at NYU in journalism to be a sports journalist, and I also did a French studies component to the degree. And in order to graduate, I had to produce a series of in-depth journalistic articles on some aspect of France, and being in the sports journalism track, that meant some aspect of French sport. This was at the time just after France won the World Cup and just after their 2000 European championship victory. And so naturally, football or soccer was the natural sport that I turned to. Looking at how it was different in France than in the United States. And at the time, my advisor at NYU, Herrick Chapman, he had two young daughters who were heavily involved in the youth soccer scene here in the United States. And in trying to talk out loud about what angle of French soccer I should possibly start looking at, he said, well, you know, my daughters play soccer here in the United States, but is it the same in France at the youth level? Is it the same type of culture? Is it the same type of participation, either for girls and or boys? Is there a gender divide? How does that happen? And you know, how do they create the players that have just been winning the the top international titles recently? So that's how I first got started on the topic of youth development in French football, French soccer. And when I went back for my PhD work, we were always instructed to find a research topic that you are going to be married to for the next several years, preferably something that has not been done before. And I thought, well, I'm very interested still in this topic of youth sport in France, because I thought it was very interesting in terms of transatlantic comparisons and quite different from what we're used to here in the United States. And no one had really looked at the history of the youth training systems for football in France. So that was kind of how I fell into my dissertation topic, and everything escalated from there. I found that in terms of the research itself, because of the sources that were available, or rather unavailable because of the relatively more recent nature of my historical work, I had to focus in the larger aspect on youth sports policy. And so the nature of what was available to me also helped to dictate my interests.
So are there many other works on youth training, whether in football or in other sports?
I think now there have. I think a lot of them have been focused more on the sociological or anthropological aspects of them. In terms of the history, I know that a lot has been done in terms of looking at the history of physical education culture at the youth level, in the schools, in the military systems. So I think it's a field that has certainly become more populated since I first started looking at this in the early 2000s.
Lindsay, your book begins with the epic meltdown of the French national team at the 2010 World Cup in South Africa. And I thought this was a fascinating episode when it was happening, from the standpoint of sport, but also from the standpoint of media in terms of how it was covered. In your book, why do you see this as a significant event? Why do you begin with this event?
I thought it was it was a nice parallel to where I wanted to, you know, begin with the more historical side of the story, with the 1960 French debacle at the Rome Olympics, when the poor French showing in terms of lack of medals, lack of victories, as it were, really led to a sense of a national crisis within the element of sports, and really started to provoke the new Fifth Republic to rethink some of its more domestic policies. Certainly under the Fifth Republic, the government is not very far away from the private lives of its citizens, and sport became one way that it became an active component of the daily lives of its citizens. This really originated after the 1960 Rome Games, and I thought that the meltdown of Les Bleus in South Africa in 2010 was kind of a very nice pillar post and parallel, and even today it's still a topic that the French media has not let go, as more recent controversies in the French press and with the French national team players demonstrates.
So let's get into the core of your book then. As you've talked about, you address how the French have trained their young athletes in the post-war period, and specifically in the time of the French Republic. But to start, I want to ask you about some background. How would you describe the sporting culture of France prior to the Second World War?
That's a very good question. I guess from our standpoint, it would be fair to say there wasn't much of a sporting culture in the way that we're used to here in the United States, where it's an integral part of one's education. You grow up playing school athletics. You play for your high school team. If you're good enough, you play at the university level and then perhaps think about going on from there or not. It seems to be kind of all permeating in many parts of U.S. society. That was not the case in French society, and I think one could argue to a certain extent is still not the case within French society today, although that's changed quite a bit since the 1970s. Prior to the Fifth Republic, sport was undertaken by individuals, certainly, but more as a leisure time activity. There was not necessarily the sense to create dedicated elite athletes to compete for the nation at major international tournaments and competitions. You know, that onus really begins with the entry of the Soviet Union into the international Olympic scene in the 1950s, and the creation of a sports arena as perhaps another front of the Cold War. So I think that's an important element to keep in mind in thinking about the differences pre- and post-war France and sports culture. Certainly, there had been attempts, dating back decades and decades by French authorities to incorporate some type of physical education elements into the educational structure of the nation's youths, particularly under the Third Republic, when mandatory physical education first became mandated in the, I believe it's the 1880s, as a way to ensure that the boys going through the national education systems would be fit enough to serve their mandatory military service in the army. And conversely, that young French girls would have strong, healthy bodies to repopulate the nation. You know, keep in mind that population element, perceived population crisis and lack of a positive birth rate weighed heavily on many French authorities for decades and decades throughout the 19th century and into the 20th century. The post-World War II baby boom is really something quite new and novel.
Mm-hmm. So, Lindsay, you already hinted at this, but I'll ask you, in the immediate wake of the war, what view did the leadership of the restored French state have of sport as part of their efforts to revive the nation?
Well, under the Fourth Republic, they continued many of the sports policies that were implemented by the late Third Republic, and then in some instances tried to be set up by the Vichy regime in terms of recognizing that physical activity for the youth would help to create stronger bodies. But there was not a huge integrated push. It really took that 1960 Rome Olympic Games to bring everyone's attention to the fact that, as de Gaulle said, the nation lacked a sports culture. The nation's youth were not interested in playing sport extensively. There was a lack of sports facilities and terrains for people who did want to practice sport to practice or compete in. And there was also no money for the training of elite athletes. So it's really the Fifth Republic where this starts to change significantly. There's a series of 5-year sports plans that are enacted in the 1960s to rectify these four main issues. A lot of money is thrown at building sports terrains, pools, race courses, at trying to encourage youths to play some more sports. It's seen as an organized leisure time activity that perhaps might also keep them away from other leisure time activities of the youths of the 1960s. You know, the adult fear of juvenile delinquency was just as potent in France as it was in the United States and other parts of the Western world in the 1950s and 1960s. So sport was kind of part of that package. Interestingly enough, despite all the efforts made by the Fifth Republic in the 1960s to rectify the so-called sports crisis, and it was augmented by the fact that the French national football team and basketball team just had poor showings throughout the decade, and these are some of the more premier prestige team sports, there was no real progress made in terms of turnaround of results. There was a little bit of an increase at the youth level in sports participation, but not the type of significant turnaround that authorities perhaps had hoped for. And so it was in the early 1970s that new methods of trying to encourage youth to play sports or to make sports easier to participate in or to practice were thought of and instituted both by the state as well as through the French Football Federation, the national governing body of the sport in the country.
So I want to clarify, though. So was President de Gaulle, was he concerned about sport culture in France in the wake of the 1960 Olympics then?
Oh, yes, very much so. And it's very much at his behest that the government authorities began investigating the perceived sports crisis and trying to come up with different ways to rectify it. News reports report that de Gaulle was enraged by the humiliation of the fact that France placed 25th in the 1960 Olympic medal table. They won no gold medals at that Olympic Games. The, you know, countries such as Ethiopia, Denmark, Japan had at least one gold medal, whereas the French had none to show. And it was particularly in certain sports where they felt like the French should have a natural inclination to place well in, such as basketball. The French authorities of the era felt that basketball was a sport that was excellent for the French psyche. It was cerebral. Mm-hmm. It was a team sport, and it was very well suited to the French. Therefore, they thought that the French should excel at it. And while the French certainly did, in terms of the immediate post-war period in 1948, the men's team took the silver medal at the Olympics. That was kind of the last big hurrah for basketball for quite a while. And so there was very much a lot of consternation, not only about the lack of a sports culture and opportunities to practice sport, but also set it against the international context of what type of image a non-winning or non-victorious France was perhaps displaying to the rest of the world at a time, particularly in 1960, a big year of decolonization, still in the last throes of the Algerian War. And it was increasingly clear at that time that the sports arena was one way to reassert oneself, to reassert one's vitality, and perhaps gain what we call, you know, soft power, mm-hmm. The ability to influence and lead through cultural pursuits or endeavors. So that really helped to shore up the realization, particularly from de Gaulle, but, you know, down the line, that this was an important endeavor.
Mm-hmm. So, Lindsay, something I appreciate about the book, and you were just hinting at it there, is you not only set the changes in sport policy within the context of political and social change in France, within France, but mm-hmm. also within this broader context of the Cold War. And you have this great line in the book in which an official with the French Basketball Federation remarks about the tall players. So players 6'7", 7 feet tall, who are playing for other countries, not for France. And mm-hmm. and he declares that a giant basketball player is like an atomic weapon, and every nation needs one of these. So I want to ask you to talk about how the tensions of the Cold War shape French policies and French rhetoric, so that even the absence of a 7-footer on the French basketball team is seen as something of a national crisis.
Certainly, you know, if the Ministry of Youth and Sports is that concerned about it, it, you know, very much ties into the Cold War. And interestingly enough, in this particular example, the lack of tall players, it's a concern that continuously plagues French basketball until the 1990s, when a new type of French player is starting to appear on the courts, and after 1997 to appear on the courts in the NBA, very tall players, many of them who have heritage in the Antilles. So trying to find tall players is a major concern for basketball, and it helps to spur the integration of sports medicine into creating elite athletes. During the Cold War, but very much concerns about trying to win, or to win in enough different types of ways, was one focus of the work of the Ministry of Youth and Sport.
So something that you don't address in the book, but I wanted to ask this, is didn't people within the Ministry of Sport in the 60s, in the wake of this debacle at the Rome Olympics, didn't they ever pause and say, yeah, we're not very good at Olympic sports, but we're really good at cycling, and let's just be happy that we're the best cyclists in the world. Why did they think that we have to compete in these other sports rather than taking pride in this sport that France is among the best nations in the world at?
I did not necessarily come across anything that would indicate that they were looking to specialize in that particular way. I definitely came across documents that reinforced the notion that there are certain prestige sports that France must compete in and must compete well in, if not win. There was very much the recognition that, you know, France was a middle-of-the-road country. It was not as large as the Soviet Union or the United States. Therefore, it did not have the same type of population or financial resources to throw at the sports project. Mm-hmm. However, you know, there was recognition that there are certain prestige sports that the French ought to compete in and ought to at least have a good showing in. Cycling, of course, was mentioned, but the main ones were track and field, swimming, skiing, basketball, and fencing. The French thought that fencing was a cerebral sport best suited for their national psyche, in the same way that they felt basketball was a sport best suited for their psyche. So that was another kind of prestige sport. And then, interestingly enough, they also considered football to be worthwhile. And granted, it was not perhaps as prestigious sport within the Olympic context as one would think, but certainly by the 1960s, it was very clear that the Football World Cup and the entity of FIFA was certainly on the ascent and perhaps in certain ways eclipsing the importance of the Olympic theater in terms of finding out the Cold War through sports. Because the thing with football and the World Cup is that you do not need to be the superpower to win. You know, the advantages enjoyed by the United States and the Soviet Union of size and population and so forth, no other country could really compete with them in the same way within the Olympic context, perhaps with the exception of East Germany, which made it their mission to do so. But for everyone else, football was a much more, it was a lower hanging fruit and something that they could both easily try to aim for, as well as realistically win. Football was not a sport that was dominated by either the Soviet Union or the United States. And so that also had an appeal as well. Plus the fact that, particularly starting with the 1966 World Cup, the huge mediatization of FIFA and football significantly helped to bolster its appeal, its popularity, and also the sport's soft influence.
So it's interesting that the ministry was this calculated in terms of determining where to put its resources for youth development, that it was thinking one, so something I picked up is that you talked about they aim for sports that they saw as according with French culture or French national mm-hmm. identity, while at the same time aiming for sports that they thought they had a good chance of winning.
Mm-hmm. Yes, certainly. And just by the nature of the documents I was looking at, they did not invest as heavily as a state in football development. They let the Football Federation do that mostly because it was the largest and the richest federation at that point in time, and therefore had the financial as well as the personnel wherewithal to do so. And there were natural tensions between the Ministry of Youth and Sport and the Football Federation, perhaps more so than some of the other examples of government and federation relations that I've seen. But I think that's an important component to keep in mind. The reason that football got so much attention is that it was the number one sport in the country amongst the youths.
So, Lindsay, you described the various programs that were put in place during the 1960s, and you mentioned earlier that these weren't successful. Why weren't they successful? Why didn't those programs work?
I think that I think there's several reasons for that, but I think primarily there are so many other leisure time activities that were competing for the interest of French youth, in the same way that I think you could say that of many of the different youth demographics in the West during the 1960s. 1960s youth culture was not necessarily country specific. There was certainly a European and also kind of a more globalized aspect of it, the appeal of rock and roll. Was one of the key foundations of that. Increased affluence in many of the Western societies helped to feed this. There is very much the culture of consumerism that fed into it as well. So there are other ways to spend one's time when you're not in school than playing sports. It starts to change a little bit in the 1970s with greater attention given by the government to try to create a sports culture by greater efforts of the three French government television stations in the 1970s to broadcast some sports on television. But this really starts to change after the liberalization of French television in 1984, where the government loosens its control over the television market and allows the first private television network in France to operate, Canal Plus. And if you remember when HBO first started here in the United States, its bread and butter were movies and boxing, so sports. Canal Plus focused on the similar program of broadcasting movies and sports, and increasingly live sports, and increasingly NBA games as well. So this very much started to create a greater inclination towards a national sports culture, if you will, or certainly a greater proclivity towards youth to see sports as something as an enjoyable leisure time, more so than perhaps at any other point in time. And certainly by the late 1970s and 1980s, you have some of the first much more modern sports stars, you know, these huge athletes who are all over the media, who are, you know, not only the symbol of your team, but also perhaps, you know, this role model, maybe not role model, but idol for many French youths.
And I want to ask about the policies of the 1970s, and you write about that France attempted to find a third way in youth training programs. So can you talk about this? What was this third way, and what did the French, the ministries and the federations, what steps did they take in trying to achieve it?
And, you know, it's really interesting that they interacted with a lot of their fellow European sports ministries or officials and went around observing different types of systems, particularly the East German system. And they liked the fact that the East German system created a dedicated way for young athletes to train, to specialize and become elite athletes from an early age. And when you look at the evolution of the youth sports programs and policies in France, they start off being heavily influenced by the East German systems, not completely. Certainly they, you know, didn't want the top-down totalitarian approach, and the doping issue within the East German schools is another issue aside. But so that's really how they start off in the mid-1970s. As sport in general in France begins to liberalize in the 1980s, including the liberalization of television, but also including a big push by the Minister of Youth and Sport in 1984, these programs start to liberalize a little bit more. They start to become not more American, but to work in closer public-private partnerships rather than totally state-funded.
And what was the place of girls in these training programs? Were athletic officials attentive to training female athletes as well?
From the documentation I've been going through, the national, so the federal sports programs for youths paid attention to both boys and girls in equal measures, particularly so in basketball, which was long considered a sport very suitable for French girls. And the French women's team has had a long history of fairly illustrious success. Within the private professional youth programs that were implemented by the Football Federation in the 1970s, by nature of their demographics, they only focused on boys. That aspect of it only began to change in the late 1980s and 1990s, as both FIFA and thus the French Football Federation made a much greater spur to encourage female participation in football and to try to change the sport's image in France as being a purely masculine one to being something that girls can do and can excel at.
Lindsay, as you looked at French training programs in the 1970s and 80s, did you see innovations or advances that were made there that we then see being adopted in other countries?
Perhaps not necessarily at the, the thing with the French systems is you have the national system and then you also have the system set up by the professional teams in certain team sports, football being the earliest, and then by the 1980s and 1990s being followed by basketball, rugby, handball, and one other team sport that I am blanking on right now. So I think you see a lot of innovation occurring within the private system of the professional football clubs in the 1980s. I think you see it cross-pollinating with the national federal system, which focuses also not just on the athletic part, but also on the educational aspect. And that cross-pollinates. And by the early 1990s, you start to have the recognition that France is producing some of the best young football talent in the world at that time. And I think many of those tactics, the combination of technical athletic training with academic training and medical supervision, they start to be taken up by other countries in terms of their national systems. That being said, you do have certain private clubs in Europe that adopt a somewhat similar model as the French prior to the 1990s. La Meza at FC Barcelona, and Ajax in the Netherlands, their youth football academies look very similar in many ways to the to the French academies of the era.
Lindsay, based on the research that you did in the documents of the ministries and so forth, what did you find in terms of the government's approach to sport and the increasingly multicultural complexion of France? So with migration into France, did French officials see the various sports academies as a way to assimilate the children of immigrants, or did the documents show that this was a problematic issue for the government?
In the government records, no, because keep in mind the government, the French government records, or at least for the Ministry of Youth and Sport, have a 30-year moratorium. So The last I was able to see was, I think, 1980, 1981 in the occasional odd file. So that wasn't even really part of the rhetoric precisely at that time. Also, keep in mind that the sports academies are different from the national sports training institutions. The sports academies is kind of the phrase given to the sports training centers that are run by the professional clubs, whereas the national and regional sports training centers, they're called CREPs, and then they all have their senior sections headquartered at the INSEP campus, the National Institute of Sport and Physical Education, right outside of Paris. So it's important to make that distinction between the terminologies. The government archives did not really mention the professional sports academies in the 1970s and 1980, other than that they were up and running and really had no comment in terms of who they were recruiting or otherwise. Mm-hmm. And that being said, you do start to get a greater public discourse in the French press, beginning in the 1980s and certainly continuing through to nowadays, about the aspect of immigration, assimilation of children or descendants of immigrants, and how sport has always, particularly team sport, has always been viewed as a way to help the assimilation process by playing for your local team, and if you're good enough playing for your national team, it really helps to consecrate a French identity of being at one with the state. You see some of that in the press, and in the 1980s you start to see a few press accounts questioning why is it that we do not see the youths of the African immigrants rising up through many of the football training centers. By the 1990s, that's not quite a concern at that point. But I think it also reflects just the different waves of immigration.
So, Lindsay, you did a lot of archival and library research. Did you also do some field work? Didn't you visit
an
academy? Yeah. What did you find there?
Super fun to do field work all the time.
I know. All the social scientists get to do that, and the historians never do.
I know. Pick a topic that's more recent. I visited the academy at Marseille and also the academy at Rennes, which I can never pronounce because I cannot roll my R. One in the north, one in the south. And it was very interesting comparing and contrasting the two centers. It also feeds into a lot of the stereotypes of the division between north and south in France. The people in the south told me things about the people in the north and vice versa. But they had many of the very same components, and all of the football youth academies in France are governed by a universal set of laws, and they're published and slightly tinkered with every year. So I did look through all of those laws that kind of set forth the overarching framework, and then within that each club can tinker as it will so that it fits their needs and their requirements while holding to the rules put forth by the Federation. But it was very much like a tiny little private boarding school. There were dormitories for the boys who would range in age between 12 or 13 at the younger end and 18, 19, 20 perhaps in some cases on the older end. There was a dedicated classroom space. There were dedicated teachers, academic teachers who were there. There is a dedicated space and training facilities and medical equipment and so forth for the youth academy players. They had the whole dining complex there, and so the youth academies were very much the senior team facilities. So very much trying to enforce a certain sense of larger family amongst the different levels of the team.
So I know that a constant concern in post-war France has been the threat of Americanization. In your research, do you find were there concerns about Americanization in French sporting culture?
That's a good question. Thinking quickly through my head, I don't necessarily see that simply because the most popular sports in France and the United States are so different. Mm-hmm. The NFL did try to have a Europe wing and play in different parts of Europe. That did not really catch on. Baseball, likewise, has not caught on significantly in France, although there certainly is a French Baseball and Softball Federation, and they're doing some interesting things. The other main American sport that became quite popular but was always had a certain degree of popularity in France is basketball. And there, I don't know if I think it's still too early on in the French basketball revolution to tell exactly if there are fears of Americanization mm-hmm. of the game in France. I think certainly the French game is much more reflective of the European or international game in general. I think there has been an increased degree of athleticism at the international level, perhaps reflective of a larger Americanization of the game. But I have not really come across sentiments or perhaps fears of that quite in the same way.
So there's no reaction against, say, French players going to the NBA?
No, really quite the contrary, because the NBA is seen as the elite league in the world for basketball. The French are very proud that they have, I think, 11 or 12 players who are on full-time NBA rosters this season. And since 2007, France has been the largest supplier of foreign or international labor in the NBA. They are quite proud of that.
We're almost out of time, Lindsay, and I want to ask about the conclusion. You have the title of the conclusion to your book is A Second Sports Crisis? Question mark. And I want to ask what this crisis is that you're warning against.
Well, in my book, I mentioned that the first sports crisis is really dovetails around this larger crisis of the nation in the 1960s and the need to reposition the nation of France and reposition its youth and its image abroad, as well as the general crisis of youth at the time, as there were in many other countries. And so that the sports crisis in the 1960s was intimately tied with these and was really held up in the lack of sporting victories. And that really helped to spur on the creation of youth sports policies in France. The second sports crisis that I allude to has to deal more with the issue of identity and sport, and you see this, I think, a lot just reflected in the coverage and continued aftermath of the 2010 meltdown of Les Bleus in South Africa. There is very much the recognition that sport is a natural way to help assimilate people into a given society, that it can speak volumes about conferring identity or representing a nation or a locality, and that there's a certain image that goes along with it, especially in this hyper-mediatized era. I think the sports crisis, the second sports crisis, is very much caught up in perhaps the crisis of French identity that you've seen manifest itself since the 1998 World Cup win, and that of a multi-ethnic France, and just what does it mean to be French these days? Who is French? What does that mean? And I think the old, you know, the old program of full assimilation into the French state, I don't think that necessarily holds today. And so I think that's where a lot of this sense of crisis and identity crisis comes from.
And following from that, so in 1998, France wins the World Cup. Mm-hmm. And so now they are no longer the nation striving to have victories. They are the victorious nation. So it's something of this mm-hmm. second crisis out of the fact that we've been on top and we need to stay there.
I think there's certainly a sense of we've been on top and then we've hit rock bottom, and why can't we get back to the top again? Certainly the 2002 World Cup was not a pretty one for France. They exited after the first round. 2006, almost there. Mm-hmm. We will not get into the Zidane headbutt, but certainly, you know, certainly 2010 really magnified this crisis of we've hit rock bottom. We produce talented players who are fairly successful in the top leagues in the world. They represent, you know, they're in a sense sports ambassadors, perhaps not officially so, but certainly visually so. Yet they cannot get it together and act as a unified team. And, you know, I think that feeds into it.
So it sounds like the work crew is getting ready for the dinner rush in the background.
Sorry, yes. The only place we have Wi-Fi in the building. Go figure.
All right. Well, since we have so much activity, I'll wrap things up, Lindsay, by asking, what are you working on now?
I'm working on two things. I think my larger project is I'm looking at the French basketball revolution, as I'm starting to call it, the turnaround of the sport, both in terms of production of victories or titles, as well as in the production of players and the place of basketball within French culture since the 1970s. And, you know, certainly kind of building through the first Frenchman to play in the NBA in 1997, and fast-forwarding to the question of why is it that France is the largest supplier of foreign players in the league today? What does that mean for French basketball? Especially the fact that not all, but many of the French NBA players can trace their roots to Guadeloupe. Is there something about that sport's role in Guadeloupean society, or a variety of different factors? So kind of looking at many of the issues that one looks at in French football, not only training and, you know, the sport's role within the larger culture and international context, but also through the issue of identity and assimilation. So that's my main project that I'm working on right now. I'm also starting to follow up on this, you know, last question you asked about the fallout of 2010 and what that means for the youth football academies and how that's being perceived and if that fits into the larger picture or not.
All right. Well, Lindsay, thank you for coming on New Books in Sports.
Thank you very much for having me.
You've been listening to an interview with Lindsay Krasnov about her book, The Making of Les Bleus, Sport in France, from 1958 to 2010, published in 2012 by Lexington Books. New Books in Sports is part of the New Books Network, which offers dozens of channels of podcast interviews with the authors of new publications on subjects from political science to popular music. If you like what you heard here, please follow New Books in Sports on Twitter at New Books Sports, or friend us on Facebook at facebook.com/newbooksinsports. I'm your host, Bruce Berglund. Thanks for listening, and enjoy your week.